Our next and last paper before our response and discussion is Stuart Smithler's The Zones of Insurrection, The Subversive Hegemon, Transgression, Transcendence, and the Public Space. Stuart got his PhD at Columbia in Religion and Buddhist Studies. He is now the chair of religion at University of Puget Sound in the Northwest, where he teaches Buddhist studies and courses in cultural studies and modernity. He is contributing editor to Tricycle, the Buddhist Review, and the president of the Rubicon Foundation, a nonprofit art and education collective that produces and hosts events through Smoke Farm Institute, the foundation's 300-acre site an hour north of Seattle. I'm kind of far from you, but I'll
try to keep
you in mind. Thank you, Stuart.
So if anybody wants to propose a residency at Smoke Farm, if you look on the website, you all seem like you're suitable people. Maybe we'll have some sort of miniature conference there. Zones of insurrection. I'm going to look at interior and exterior zones, and they'll be grouped in loosely. They'll take place in these considerations take place in three geographical areas: the prison yard, the public square, and cemeteries. I take my inspiration from Benjamin's fourth thesis in the concept of history. I'm going to quote that briefly now. The class struggle, which is always present to a historian influenced by Marx, is a fight for the crude and material things without which no refined and spiritual things could exist. Nevertheless, it is not in the form of the spoils that fall to the victor that the latter make their presence felt in the class struggle. They manifest themselves in this struggle as courage, humor, cunning, and fortitude. So, in other words, the things that you're looking for appear in the class struggle, not after the class struggle, if you're looking for those spiritual, Benjaminian spiritual dimensions. They have a retroactive force and will constantly call in question every victory, past and present, of the rulers. As flowers turn toward the sun, by dint of a secret heliotropism, the past strives to turn toward the sun, which is rising in the sky of history. A historical materialist must be aware of this most inconspicuous of all transformations. So then I've grouped these comments in those four virtues, if you like. Cunning, humor, courage, and fortitude. The first one is cunning. I've been teaching philosophy in two Washington State prisons, the Monroe Prison and more recently the Washington Correctional Center for Women, or as it's usually known, Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y, Purdy Prison. I'm sure that many of you have been inside prisons and are familiar with the surreal sense of control and surveillance, and are equally familiar with the theories of Foucault and others regarding discipline and punishment. One of the clear agenda items in prison is to strip the offender, the prisoner, of any sense of power or authority. There are many ways the prison industrial complex introduces and adapts methods meant to essentially dehumanize offenders. But perhaps one of the most effective, universal, and unquestioned methods is to severely restrict or totally eliminate any sense of privacy. In addition to controlling their actions, guards aggressively observe prisoners on camera, from behind glass, in passing, what they call movement. When you pass between buildings, and they're in the, they call it movement. And in their cells, they read their letters. There's no such thing as a private letter. They have no access to the internet. Guards and administration officials tend to view offenders as objects or even commodities in their relation to job production in the local economies and in relation to profit and the privatization of the prison industry. Their lives and past actions are considered open books. Prisoners do not enjoy the privilege of anonymity, which is a subset of privacy. One of the great joys to emerge from the development of city life, I think, is the freedom to remain as anonymous and private in the public space as one wishes. The daily exchange with the barista you see most mornings creates a space in which both are equal to engage or withdraw, reveal or conceal as much as one wants. Not so the prisoner, whose whereabouts and actions are constantly observed and recorded as they sign roll call sheets repeatedly throughout the day and display their name and number badge at all times. Of course, there remains a hidden dimension to the lives of prisoners, a private space that is the space in their heads. The state, authorities, and corporations would very much like to gain access to that space as well, and they often succeed. But in some cases, prisoners continue to demonstrate creative methods of resistance, and in the process seem to be able to protect their own humanity. I think you might agree that prison is public space, and for most offenders, prison approaches total public space. In discussing the prison yard, I'm locating a space that is fluid and is a special space within the totality. It is, in a way, the commons, the controlled commons of prisoners. In the prison yard, prisoners are mostly allowed to mix among themselves, entertain themselves with sports, other activities. However, they are constantly observed, but from afar. And this distance, a small crack in an otherwise dehumanizing lack of privacy, allows resistance to take shape. It is in this space that groups form. It is in this very human activity that threatens total control and domination. The most influential group to form in Monroe Prison has been the Black Prisoners Caucus. When I started working with prisoners from that caucus, I was struck by the way they carried themselves. Their posture was consistently upright. Their demeanor was direct and contained. More importantly, and this is in comparison to the other prisoners, more importantly, even though they wore the same regulation clothing as the other prisoners, their clothes were meticulously clean, their shirts perfectly pressed, almost shiny. And this matched their general appearance. I did not reflect on this much until I started teaching at the women's prison in Purdy. Education funding for prisons virtually disappeared when Congress eliminated offenders' eligibility for Pell Grants in 1994. In Washington State, a few groups have tried to step in to help with college-level teaching, but women have always been ignored. A group of women in Purdy, like the Black Prisoners Caucus in Monroe, began to organize themselves last year. They wanted access to learning and thinking, but the educational aspect was part of a bigger project they had in mind. Essentially, they wanted to take over the prison. That is to say, and actually this goes back, there's an earlier, the Black Panthers in Walla Walla in the 70s and 80s had the same agenda. They literally wanted to take over the prison from the inside. They didn't think they were going to get out. They wanted to take over the prison, and not in a strike that was actually going to dominate, but actually transform it and make it their place. So these women, quite independently, had their own, a similar agenda, to take over the prison. That is to say, they wanted to transform the culture, take over their lives. The impetus for this movement was the realization by long-term offenders and women serving life sentences, some of my students, have a life sentence, you have to have murdered somebody. The realization of long-term offenders that the prison was their life, the prison was their home, and they might as well be homeowners. That's kind of funny. While the women were forming their group, it's kind of an unfortunate name, they called themselves the Village, and the other prisoners have made jokes, they called them the Village People. they're aware of the joke, they're kind of using it. The prison underwent a change of leadership with a new superintendent. A new associate superintendent, sympathetic and supportive of this initiative, contacted me and asked if I'd meet with him, which I did. So after a while, we gained each other's confidence, and I learned, I was struck by the same thing that was happening, that their appearance was radically different than the other prisoners. They took pains about their appearance. They had makeup and there's a real solidarity around appearance, right? As we gained each other's confidence, I learned that the women adopted these bourgeois manners as a form of resistance and self-determination. Wearing makeup, dressing well, excellent hygiene, and respectful manners were forms of resistance in which the meaning of these actions were inverted. On the outside, these actions would go outside the prison. These actions would go unnoticed and unobserved as meaningless conformity. But inside the prison, the world of total public space where everything is visible, the prisoners are other. The adoption of a bourgeois appearance, and their visible independence was a sign, was a sign of their independence, strength, and will to self-determination. As the villages coalesced and developed a clear and very visible identity, they have, in some sense, begun to reform and repossess the public sphere of the prison. I mean, this is a very self-conscious thing. They know what they're doing. I mean, I've spoken with them about it. It's not they're just accidentally trying to, you know, they just look good or something. So they've begun to reform and repossess the public sphere, the prison, recapturing some of the potential of the public space, like Habermas says, where private individuals meet, restoring, redeeming, or protecting the subjectivity and humanity of prisoners. The women have cracked the public totality, and with it the uncontested domination and authority of the guards. The secret, hidden in plain sight uprising is working. The more educated and bourgeois administrators, than the guards, have begun to listen more openly to the complaints, right, of the prisoners. There's always, I mean, the interesting question is almost platonic, which is the administrators have sort of been removed, and the tension's always been between the guards and the prisoners, and that's where a lot of the abuse takes place. And now they sort of crack that, and the administrators have appeared sort of in between, and they're listening to the prisoners in a very different sense, which is starting to change the whole environment. Let's see. So they're listening to the complaints of some of the prisoners, and some of the guards, while still very much in control and possessing authority, reveal a new nervousness and unease. Just a few weeks ago, I was leaving the prison at night, and the guard at the front desk asked me, "What are they up to? What is this village all about?" He was suspicious, and it was very clear that he felt, in a superficial way, insecurity and threat. Not physical threat, obviously. The public sphere of pretty prison is in play, and it will be very interesting to see what happens and how these women subvert this surplus repression. The surplus repression in prison life and the master-slave relationship that characterizes prison life might easily lead one to conclude that the politics inside the prison industrial complex is a vestige of classical historical domination. Dual, personal, and agonistic domination persists. But at the same time, these women are working from the inside, employing strategies of inversion, the inversion of the meaning of manners. They're not directed against anyone, any particular person. Baudrillard says, hegemony works through general masquerade. And in this instance, the powers are beginning to sense the carnivalesque reality that everything is not what it seems to be. The masquerade of hegemony is confronted with the masquerade of resistance. And, you know, when I say resistance and revolution, all that sort of stuff, I know that I'm sort of being loose with theoretical categories. Humor. A scene from Al Jazeera's live streams. The protesters held Tahrir Square. The police had everywhere disappeared, hoping for anonymity. The army was curiously neutral as pro-Mubarak supporters, allegedly released prisoners and paid thugs, attacked the protesters. Many of you will remember the fantastic images of a makeshift cavalry, a bizarre horseback charge against the protesters by armed pro-Mubarak thugs, mostly clubs and things, not guns. And let's not forget the lone camel rider. Remember that guy? It's fantastic. Galloping past tanks and lurching through the demonstrators. The chaotic scene would have been pure spectacle in theater had there not been real injuries. During the 18 days that protesters massed in Tahrir Square, humor and sarcasm were central to growing sense of purpose and solidarity. Fahmy Hoedi, a Cairo columnist, reported that while Mubarak's thugs threw rocks, the people charged Mubarak with, quote, jokes and comedy. Immediately after the retreat of the cavalry, of the threatening but comic nevertheless camel charge, the besieged demonstrators erected a sort of shrine or a trophy out of all the bits and pieces they had ripped and stripped from the riders and their equipment as they rode through the crowd. The humor in Tahrir Square was both planned and spontaneous. In order to motivate participation, the organizers encouraged students to make humorous signs and create caricatures. One of the organizers, a math professor at Cairo University, referred to these efforts to employ humor as one of the main tools of the rebellion, one of our main weapons. Marcuse recognized this as a possibility in his essay on liberation. And I suppose it's the reason why we can feel okay about watching Jon Stewart instead of the NewsHour. In some sectors of the opposition, the radical protest, this is Marcuse, the radical protest tends to be antinomian, anarchistic, and even non-political. Here is the reason why rebellion often takes on the weird and clownish forms which get on the nerves of the establishment. In the face of the gruesomely serious totality of institutionalized politics, satire, irony, and laughing provocation become a necessary dimension of the new politics. The contempt for the deadly esprit de sérieux, which permeates the talking and doing of the professional and semi-professional politicians, appears as contempt for the values they profess while destroying them. The rebels revive the desperate laughter and the cynical defiance of the fool as means for demasking the deeds of the serious ones who govern the whole. I'll skip in. Let's see here. Well, this is the main one. Courage. There are two different kinds of courage. One type of courage issues from a certain duality. One knows that one is afraid of